So please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. The fundamental issues in this case really.
State your name and your attorney number.
I'm sorry.
They're taping this. People might want to know who you are.
I am Langdon Jorgensen, registration number 13302. The fundamental issues in this case, Your Honor, involve basically whether or not a presumption of a gift by putting property into both names and then Moncrief decision controls when the parties have entered into an agreement, specifically calling for the waiver by one party's interest in property, in this case real property, and secondly, whether or not the presumption of a gift by putting property in both names during the marriage excuses the court or a party from satisfying the elements required to prove the existence of a gift. In a factual background, essentially what happened on the real property is that it's undisputed that Ms. Heil, Hutchinson at the time before marriage, had an interest in two homes with her prior husband. Both homes were sold. There was an agreement between her and her prior husband during the divorce that she could buy another house. She entered into a contract to sell, contract to buy a new house, found she couldn't get a mortgage, no work, didn't have maintenance at the time. And so she asked Mr. Heil, with whom she was dating for the last 4 months, to assist her in getting a mortgage. He did so. The parties entered into an agreement.
How did he assist her?
Just signed up on the mortgage. She paid 100% of the purchase price.
But he agreed to be liable for the promissory note under the mortgage?
Correct.
And as a result, he got an interest in the house?
Yes.
I mean, the title of the house?
Yes. So what happened is, subsequent to that, parties entered into an agreement whereby Mr. Heil specifically acknowledged he signed only as an accommodation party. The entire price was paid by Ms. Heil, Hutchinson at the time. She'd be solely responsible for the costs of the house, and he waived any interest that he has no interest and she'll claim no interest in the house.
Did she indemnify him against any liability he may have as a co-maker on the note?
Yes. What happened is that the divorce proceeded, the first divorce. I was her counsel in that case, and went to trial. We claimed that essentially that this house was excluded by a valid agreement of the parties under 1410.113 subsection 2D. So it was basically her separate property, her premarital property. The agreement specifically indicated that he does not and shall not have any interest in the house.
Wait, is Mr. Heil has the...
Right.
I thought you thought about the other divorce.
Oh, I'm sorry. No.
You said it. Okay.
The husband in the other divorce agreed that she could sell the other two houses, use the money to basically buy this house.
I don't want to tie this up in too long length, because how is this an accommodation? How does this anything to do with the first divorce? Putting his name on the mortgage. What does that have anything to do with the first divorce? None as far as you're concerned.
Well, it... None for purposes of this case.
All your client is saying is the only reason she did this arrangement was to get a mortgage.
Right.
Okay.
So bottom line on it is we said that it was that agreement where he waived any interest was an exclusion of that jointly titled asset from being marital property by a valid agreement with the parties under 1410.113.2D. When we tried the issue, essentially, the trial court said, first of all, he found the house to be marital property, and the reason was because they hadn't recorded the agreement. And second of all, the deed, the proclaimed deed that Mr. Heil signed at the time, was not itself recorded. And so the court said, because the deed wasn't recorded and the agreement wasn't recorded, that it's marital property. That was the first grounds.
Didn't he go a little bit further and say subsequent events also supported the conclusion that if it wasn't marital property, it became marital property?
Yes, but that was the first grounds I was going to address first. The second grounds was exactly as Your Honor perceived. The case law is clear that a conveyance or a release of an interest in property need not be recorded to be effective between the parties, and the other side cites no authority on appeal, doesn't seem to rely on that argument. With respect to Your Honor's question about subsequent events, what transpired was that subsequent to the marriage, approximately a year later, that was a 31-month marriage before the parties separated, when Ms. Heil got her assets from the first divorce, she she wanted to refinance the property, and they essentially did so. The evidence was undisputed, and I quoted the testimony of the parties and agrees that the they needed to execute a new quitclaim deed because of Ms. Hutchinson's name change to Heil when she married. The mortgage needed to be in the same name as the property needed to be the same name as the mortgage.
Was Mr. Heil a co-maker on the promissory note in the second refi?
As in both, yes.
Okay. Was there a subsequent agreement indemnifying him against his liability as a co-maker of the second promissory note?
Was not a second agreement. Our premise is that the prior agreement, which had, by its terms, prospective application, said he shall not have an interest in the property, continued in effect.
Well, did the language of the initial agreement also indemnify him against liability on the refi?
I didn't mention a refi.
Okay.
And so it did also have prospective application in terms of Ms. Heil's obligation for indemnification.
But after the refinance, the status was the same. He was on the title to the property. He was on the note.
Right. The only change in the transaction was essentially
her name was
the name of my client. So, and
let me just pursue. Is there any evidence in the record that the purpose of recording the second quitclaim deed was somehow to disavow the earlier agreement in which he disclaimed an interest in the property?
No evidence in the record whatsoever, Your Honor.
Okay.
Right. So, bottom line on it is that we argued, and we argued an appeal, that the prior agreement continues in effect on its face in a prospective application. The only way to avoid the agreement, a subsequent act is abandonment. We cited the authority that abandonment essentially requires positive, unequivocal acts inconsistent with an intent to be further bound, coupled with the other party's acquiescence with such acts.
Counsel, let me ask you, didn't the husband in this case testify either A, no, we created this earlier agreement, not as a sham, but as a, for a different purpose. Or didn't the husband testify that even if we had done the earlier agreement, later on we took it back? Was there testimony from the husband essentially trying to nullify the effect of the agreement?
I believe that he said that, he claimed that the agreement was a sham. It's hard to argue, I think, as a matter of law, because the parole evidence rule, which basically indicates that any prior discussions, negotiations must be disregarded. The agreement's clear and unambiguous on its face. And so basically, I believe the agreement is the agreement.
Was there an objection to the parole evidence rule based and lodged in the trial court?
I don't recall, Your Honor. I just don't recall. It's a matter of substantive law as well, Your Honor. I just have an evidentiary objection. But in terms of the abandonment issue, there was no real unequivocal acts inconsistent with the prior agreement. It was a mortgage transaction to begin with, and was after the marriage as well. And that was the exclusive testimony of the parties in terms of why the new deed was prepared. Secondly, Your Honor, just as an aside, I should note that counsel has argued on appeal that that prior agreement is in the nature of a marital agreement. A marital agreement by decree. And they say that the agreement should be invalid because there weren't disclosures. That was not an argument made below, but to address it, first of all, remember that the parties essentially did a mortgage application together. It's inconceivable that Ms. Heil, then Hutchinson, would not have revealed her finances to get a mortgage in the application they both submitted. The second thing is that even if we analyze it under a marital agreement, I believe the continued validity of the agreement is even more clear. Under 14.10.306, the Uniform Marital Agreements Act provides that after a marital agreement becomes effective, it may be amended or revoked only by written agreement of the parties. 14.2.307.3 provides a marital agreement should not become unenforceable because of the occurrence of any other event. Your question, the subsequent event. Basically, refinancing the property and declaring your question deed, essentially, to correct to the married name, is the subsequent event, and it doesn't invalidate the agreement. There's nothing, as far as a written agreement, saying that the prior agreement which has effective application, would not have further application. Your Honor, the second issue under Moncrief, I think, is important, is we all know that Moncrief provides that in the event of you put property in both names, is a presumption of a gift. The question is basically whether or not that presumption overcomes the need to demonstrate the elements of the gift. Now, case law in Colorado concerning gifts is quite clear. Gomer versus Hartman cited in the briefs indicates that the quotation, the essential elements of a gift are clear, unmistakable intention to make a gift, and complete parting of possession and control over the donee. Now, if you put something in the joint names that doesn't part possession and control, the Adler case, which is at page 18 of the open brief, I think is important. Consistently, Colorado courts resolve that basically held that putting money into a joint account does not satisfy the completion of the elements of a gift. The Adler decision states, I mean, we can quote, because I think this is important.
Well, Adler was a marriage case, wasn't it?
Adler was not a marriage case. Levy Olson cited a counsel was a marriage case.
Okay. But are you asking us to agree that that this line of authority on gifts would be determinative for purposes of the joint property or marital property inquiry in this case?
What I am asking the court to do specifically is that there's a presumption of a gift under Moncrief. The established case law concerning gifts, whether it be probate or the law of gifts itself, requires or says that merely putting money into a joint account, this is only for money into a joint account, it's not like real estate, does not satisfy the elements of a gift because one does not surrender dominion and control.
Okay, are there any marriage cases? I understand your argument.
Yes.
Are there any dissolution cases that adopt this surrender control test where money's been placed into a joint account?
Your Honor, I don't think so. I don't think that the decisions that the trial courts have been entering on this issue, on this specific item, has ever gotten to this level before. The whole question, really, is whether or not a presumption of a gift satisfies the requirement unambiguously stated as essential elements of a gift to surrender dominion and control suffices. Case law and every other area of law, we cite extensive cases, we even refer to Love B. Olson cited by counsel in their answer brief, that to constitute a gift, to deposit funds into a joint account is not a completed gift until someone actually withdraws the money and converts it, so it's just rendered dominion and control.
In which case holds that, please? That there actually has to be a withdrawal?
Yes, there's two of them. I cite Adler's versus Young cited at page 17 and on to 18 of our reply brief, and it's quoted at length there. And then lastly, Love V. Olson, if the court looks at that, that was cited by respondent's answer brief. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Angela Whitford, registration number 39309, appearing on behalf of the appellee in this matter, Stephen Heil, who was the respondent below, also husband, coming from the husband and wife in this matter. Notably absent from the discussion here today by oral argument by Mr. Jordan, Mr. Jordanson, is any discussion of a standard review in this case. The wife, in her opening brief, argues that the appropriate standard review is a de novo standard. This is clearly in error. Contrary to wife's allegations, the trial court in this matter, all those decisions are judged by an abuse of discretion standard.
Isn't part of abuse of discretion the question whether or not the trial court misapplied or misunderstood the law?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And to the extent we're concerned with that, would that be a de novo review?
Your Honor, under how the errors by the trial court have been briefed in this matter, the trial court was not applying any incorrect legal standard. And I can specifically address each of the three issues that have been raised. What the appellant is trying to do is twist the abuse of discretion standard and try and argue that the court was either creating a new legal standard or misapplying the legal standard. So for example, Your Honor, when we're dealing with the determination that the Buffalo Ridge property was a marital asset, the applicable standard is the court applied Moncrief. The burden is on the wife to demonstrate that because the property is jointly held, that she needs to overcome that burden and demonstrate to the court that it was in fact separate property.
What about the fact that she produces an agreement and a quitclaim deed?
Your Honor, what the court did, what the trial court did, was not determine that as a matter of law, the agreement in 2007 or the August 2007 quitclaim deed were ineffective because they weren't recorded. Those were two factors in the court's overall determination and factual analysis.
What purpose would those documents have served if they were not supposed to have some meaning?
Your Honor, because Ms. Heil was going through her prior divorce at the time, there were temporary injunctions in place in that divorce case that prevented her from transferring and disposing of what was arguably marital property in that case. So the issue with her selling the California properties and using that money, buying a new house, and having Mr. Heil on the title to that property, he would then be creating an interest in that piece of property. Ms. Heil was trying to avoid contempt charges in her prior divorce case.
Did the trial court acknowledge that testimony or evidence to that effect in its ruling?
The trial court did not explicitly acknowledge that portion of the testimony. That was testimony by Mr. Heil explaining why he agreed to sign that agreement. Notably, Your Honor, there was significant testimony at trial by Mr. Heil as to why he signed that agreement. It was the agreement among the parties that he was going to sign this agreement so that Ms. Heil would not have any issues in her other divorce case.
Run that by me again. How does his becoming a quote-unquote accommodation party on a mortgage have anything to do with the divorce case? She argued that now this property is not part of the other marital estate because his name is.
It would potentially subject her, Your Honor, to a contempt proceeding in her prior divorce because of the injunctions that go into place. She would have arguably been disposing of marital property by putting Mr. Heil on title and arguably having him be a joint owner of that parcel of property. Her other prior husband could have argued that she was dissipating marital assets and bring contempt charges. So in order to avoid any appearance of, I guess, impropriety or any issues in that case, they entered into this agreement. Ms. Heil represented to Mr. Heil that this agreement simply was to make sure that there wasn't problems in her other case. They always intended to purchase the Buffalo Ridge home together. They were going to be married. She sold her property, moved into his residence. They then sold his residence, moved into the Buffalo Ridge property.
Did the trial court find that not only the agreement was unenforceable because it hadn't been recorded, did the trial court ever make a finding that, you know, as a matter of fact, the parties never from the very beginning intended the agreement to have effect?
The trial court did not go that far and explicitly make that determination.
Well, then let me ask you, how can we make credibility determinations as to whether or not to believe husband's testimony at this point as to the purpose of the agreement or the sham purpose of the agreement?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the trial court was in a unique position to, at the time, assess the credibility of the witnesses and weigh the evidence.
And he didn't do that, though. He didn't say that the agreement was never to be given effect.
Your Honor, what he did say in his permanent orders was that the party's actions 6 years prior to the dissolution of the marriage, specifically the party's actions in 2010, weighed against the fact that they had this agreement that Mr. Heil was never supposed to have an interest in the property. The parties not only executed a quitclaim deed as part of the refi with both of their names on the property, but also a deed of trust, but they also executed a quitclaim deed. The quitclaim deed in 2010 is very different than the original special warranty deed that was issued in 2007 when the property was purchased.
How is it different? Your briefs refer both of them as quitclaim deeds.
Yeah, Your Honor, in 2007 there was a special warranty deed that went from the seller to the buyers, which were Mr. Heil and Ms. Hutchinson at the time. The 2010 quitclaim deed specifically references the fact that they owned the property as husband and wife with right of survivorship, not as joint tenants in common.
And who do they quit claim it to? Back to themselves, but her name now, instead of being whatever it was, is now Heil.
Yes.
That's the only difference.
But they include specific language that they are owning the property as husband and wife with the right of survivorship. Mm-hmm. That is different legally and technically mm-hmm. than two, even third parties owning a parcel of property.
Well, but isn't it a legal misdemeanor? Aren't both deeds written that way just because those were the facts? The people weren't married in 2007, so that deed couldn't have described them as husband and wife. They were married in 2010, so the quitclaim deed had to describe them as husband and wife.
Correct. However, it is evidence which the trial court relied upon to demonstrate and support his finding that this, in fact, was a marital piece of property, that Ms. Heil did not overcome her burden of proving that this was, in fact, separate property.
Can you point to any evidence in the record that the parties, or even one of them, intended the recording of the 2010 quitclaim deed as a disavowal of the no interest in the property agreement?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Heil testified that at all times he believed that they purchased the property together, intended to own the property together, and we cite his testimony in our answer brief for that proposition.
My question, though, is a little bit different. Anybody testify that the execution and recording of the quitclaim deed was our way of tearing up the prior agreement?
The testimony was not on that issue, because Mr. Heil believed at all points in time that he owned the property and it was the intent of the parties to own the property together. As a matter of law, we argue in our answer brief that the 2010 quitclaim deed, as a matter of law, voided the August 2007 unrecorded quitclaim deed.
That's not going to go very far. Let me ask you a different question, or perhaps a different question. Did the trial court ever find that under the totality of the circumstances, it concluded that there was never an intent to have the original agreement be effective? Did the trial court go that far?
The trial court made the determination that the agreement was itself ineffective.
I know, but did the trial court say it's ineffective as a result of the new 2010 arrangements with respect to the property, or was it always ineffective, which would go along with husband's testimony?
Your Honor, the trial court is silent on that piece of it. What the trial court did was take all of the testimony, all of the evidence, weighed that, assessed the credibility of the witnesses, and in its discretion made that determination.
And said that the agreement became ineffective as a result of these filings in 2010.
Your Honor, the court doesn't need to go there, because the analysis is not whether that agreement was effective or not. The analysis is whether or not the evidence as a whole presented sustained Ms. Heil's burden of demonstrating that it was separate property versus marital property. The presumption under Moncrief is that because the property is jointly titled, that it is in fact marital property.
What was in Moncrief, was there an agreement disavowing the joint title?
No, Your Honor, there was explanation and testimony as to why the party titled the property the way that they did, and in Moncrief, the court did not accept that explanation.
Okay, well, isn't this case different? Because there's an express agreement in which Mr. Heil disavows any rights of ownership in the property and is indemnified from any liability in connection with the mortgage.
Your Honor, as we've referenced in our answer brief, the fact that this was an agreement entered into in contemplation of marriage makes it a marital agreement, which is what the appellant is arguing. However, it is not the flaw in her argument is that it is not a valid marital agreement.
Was that argued below?
Your Honor, that issue was not raised below, that it was in fact a valid marital agreement.
Well, below, wife relied on the agreement.
Correct.
Okay, did husband in the trial court argue that this was an invalid agreement because it didn't comply with the statutory requirements of disclosure for a prenup?
No, Your Honor, he simply argued that it was entered into for really limited purposes, that in essence it was simply a sham transaction, that there was no consideration given, there was no disclosure made, there was nothing beyond the fact that we need to do this period in time, but moving forward, we have all intents to own this property together.
Okay, thank you. Was the second mortgage marital debt?
Your Honor, it is a debt on the property. It was argued that the home itself was all of it was marital. So yes, it would have been marital debt.
And none of it was allocated to the husband?
The mortgage itself was not allocated to the husband. What the trial court did, acknowledging that there's a mortgage on the property, it valued the property and then in its discretion carved out a portion of that value for his overall allocation to the husband.
Right, but that valuation didn't include the deduction or reduction by the extent of the mortgage, did it?
The valuation, no, Your Honor, but the court's overall allocation of assets in this matter did.
Well, the court the denial of the post-conviction or post-conviction, post-trial.
Possibly conviction.
Thank you. Said something like it would be inequitable to ascribe any of that debt to the husband. Why would it be inequitable to do so?
Your Honor, because of the court's overall allocation of assets to the husband in this matter, the court was not allocating, for example, doing a 50-50 allocation. So the wife was receiving the lion's share of the assets in this matter, and the court sitting in equity determined that it was appropriate then for the wife to shoulder the debt associated with that asset. So we're looking at a small piece of the marital asset that was allocated to the husband in this case. And the trial court specifically in its permanent orders acknowledges that it does not do a mathematical division or allocation. He's looking at an overall equitable resolution.
And I'm trying to understand, why is it equitable for basically him to get 10% or 20% value of the house, not reduced by any kind of mortgage liability? Why is it equitable?
The reason it was equitable is because of the other distributions to wife as part of the overall allocation. The court acknowledged not only did respondent contribute to the home with his sweat equity, labor, etc. He also contributed to marital expenses, but not to the same degree that wife did. He acknowledged that, and that's why his allocation was what it was. But it has to be viewed in the overall allocation. It is not an asset-by-asset division in this case.
Did she make all the mortgage payments?
Not all of them, Your Honor.
Did he make some of them?
Several of the mortgage payments at the tail end prior to the divorce being filed were paid out of Mr. Howell's bank account. And so, Your Honor, we really want to look at this case in the light that it needs to be seen in, that this is clearly an abuse of discretion standard. The attempt by the appellant to create a de novo review for this court on all three of these issues demonstrates, as we've argued in our answer brief, the frivolous nature of this appeal. There is no credible evidence presented by the wife in this matter to demonstrate that the trial court abused its discretion.
Are you saying this is a frivolous appeal?
Yes, Your Honor, and we've briefed it in our answer brief, and we don't take that lightly. The standards that they're articulating, they cannot sustain that burden. There is evidence and support in the record for each of the determinations that the trial court made.
That doesn't mean that to take issue with them on appeal is frivolous.
Your Honor, she's twisting the standard that is applicable in this case, and if you apply the abuse of discretion standard, you see that there's no evidence to sustain her appeal.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
To answer some of the court's questions, there were three mortgage payments that were made out of the joint account. The joint account was funded primarily by my client with her divorce settlement. $3.8 million she left the marriage with $2 million in her investment accounts. She funded the joint account, so there were three payments out of it. With respect to the court's question about the second mortgage, whether or not it was marital debt, Your Honor, the agreement with the indemnification clause, excluding it from marriage, made it, I think, her debt. I think.
Could you enforce that?
Yeah. And in terms of Your Honor's question about whether Moncrief involved an agreement, as in this case, clearly it did not. In terms of the valuation issue that you just shared, asked about, I didn't want to waive that by not mentioning it in my argument because I was trying to focus on what I see as the central issues. But obviously, that was kind of like a case when the court overlooked the appraisal of essentially trying to take the decision right at earlier and trying to, you know, make it fit, so to speak. I've done some carpentry. I've had to make it fit. But essentially, the valuation did not include the debt. And I think if you're saying 10% of the value of the husband or that value of the house, and that included the debt, makes it clear that you did it when you valued at $1.4 million versus the net after the debt.
Let me ask you, counsel.
Yes.
Assuming there was some error in that, what percentage of the overall marital estate would that error have represented, and would that have constituted de minimis error under our case law?
Well, given that the assets before the award to husband had been depleted down to $2 million, we're talking somewhere around 7.5%, I think, in terms of, I'm talking about the investment accounts. And I can tell you that with no source of income and relying solely off the return on the investment accounts, the $140,000 is a big deal.
Your time's exhausted. I want to ask one question.
Yes, sir.
Let's assume that we were going to reverse in part and say that the court erred by giving Mr. Heil 10% of the value of the house rather than 10% of the equity, which would be a difference of about $70,000. Wouldn't we then have to allow the lower court to reopen the entire property distribution so that the lower court would have the opportunity to say, you know, I really meant to give Mr. Heil $140,000. I don't care where it comes from, so I'm going to give it to him from some other source than the house. I mean, I'm not saying the judge would do that, but wouldn't we have to give the judge that opportunity?
Your Honor, I don't think on a clear error issue like that we have to upset the whole apple cart, but that's certainly within the court's discretion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course. That completes our docket.